This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 7:13. You're listening to the Evening Edition with Sharmila and Lynn. Up next, Mind Your Business, our weekly highlight of some of the major news stories this week that affect businesses in Malaysia.
So we've got a pair and we're going to kind of deep dive into them. First up, we're going to be talking about the flash floods that, of course, happened in the Klang Valley earlier this week, affecting a number of major roads. And we want to talk about basically how this is going to impact businesses, because obviously, as well as the economy. And after that, updates on our foreign worker situation, because the Malaysian Employers Federation is calling on the government to allow refugees and undocumented foreign workers to work legally in the country to ease the acute labour shortage. And it's especially pressing because, well, we're still waiting on that MOU.
If you're a business owner, we'd like to hear from you. How have the floods impacted your business? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now to discuss these stories is Dr. Melati Nungsari, Assistant Professor of Economics at the Asia School of Business and Research Affiliate at MIT in Boston. Dr. Melati, thanks for speaking with us today. Now, let's start with the flash flooding. How will businesses, particularly SMEs, be impacted by this, and what effects might this have on our economy?
So I think the first thing to note, and I think something that we all know, is that SMEs play a huge role in our economy. So I think about like 48% of our workforce is employed by SMEs. So that's a huge number of people. So with, you know, things like flooding, we can expect disruptions to businesses, we can expect destroyed warehouses, we can expect flooded facilities like factories, supply chain issues, and then, of course, loss in productivity from people not being able to go to work. So I tried to look up some statistics on this. And the thing to note is that this is sort of becoming what we call in game theory, a repeated game, meaning it's happening over and over again. And, you know, even way back in 2017 with the floods in Kedah and Penang, I think the estimates in terms of destruction by the Federation of Malaysian Manufacturers was, I think, 200 million plus 3,000 SMEs that had to halt operations due to the flooding. And so that was way back, you know, 5 years ago. And I think we will see numbers like that as well from, you know, this flooding and floodings to come. And so we need to think about this as sort of something that is becoming a norm, becoming something that will happen more frequently. And it's a huge issue, I think, for the country to deal with, but also for workers and employers to think about. And if I could just add one last thing. So you know, when I said repeated games, the repeated games in game theory, the idea with repeated games is that your strategy, so what you should do in these sort of interactions, should be very different than one-time, one-shot games. And so I fear that we're still using one-time, one-shot strategies in a world where this is becoming more and more frequent. So that to me is a bit worrying.
Now, the floods have, of course, been happening across states, but could you tell us about the significance of high density and economy heavy areas like the Klang Valley being hit by floods and the financial losses it incurs?
So the fact that this keeps on happening, I think, in Klang Valley, which is, like you mentioned, sort of the economic heart of the country, is really terrible, actually, for our economy. So I'd like to sort of bring one particular point to mind, which is commuting. So aside from, you know, what I mentioned with losses of machinery, equipment, supply chain disruptions, there's also this uncertainty with people trying to get to work and trying to get back home from work. And so if we think about commuting being very difficult, we see a lot of traffic. We know from a lot of studies that there's a lot of loss in productivity and time sitting in traffic jams. I think the financial impact and loss of this, of having workers basically being underutilized or unutilized because they're sitting in traffic, is a huge loss to the economy. And so one thing that I have been a bit curious to see is whether or not working from home will become more of a norm because of these climate-induced sort of crises, as well as, you know, with COVID mitigation. So we'll see what happens with that. But I think the effect on individual workers can really not be, you know, sort of underscored more, that we're losing a lot from, you know, just trying to do our day-to-day life.
So we've seen considerable damage to our infrastructure, vehicles, public assets. Help us understand the scale of resources that the government has to put towards recovery efforts.
So I think, like I said in my first answer, so we need to think about this as sort of a repeated game, right? It's not a one-shot game. It's something that's going to probably keep on happening. And so all of the resources needed for recovery is not really only going to be recovery. It's going to be, you know, mitigation. So climate mitigation, climate adaptation. And so what does that mean, right? So mitigation means, like, what are we doing as a society to reduce climate change overall? So what are we doing to, you know, reduce the emissions that we're having, do sort of big steps in order to, you know, mitigate basically climate change? And so to an extent, there is not much individuals can do about this. So the second thing we need to focus on is adaptation. So how do we adapt to life in you know, constantly changing climate, which will involve adjusting to, you know, different things, right? So you mentioned damage to vehicles. I think one thing that a lot of people in Klang Valley have since adapted to is buying vehicle insurance that covers flooding, which is something that we maybe did not consider before, but again, sort of a strategy to adapt to the reality that we face now.
Let's hone in on how floods affect vulnerable groups like people from low-income families, the rural poor. What are some factors at play here that make these groups more likely to suffer the long-term effects of floods?
So I think the first thing to note is that poor people are going to be just disproportionately affected by any sort of what we call negative shock, right? And I would say that flooding is a definite, a very real negative shock. But honestly, we don't really have to look very far. I mean, you mentioned rural poor, but recently the floods, I think in December, in Shah Alam, in the richest state in Peninsula, we still had, you know, 30-something people dying from flooding. We had thousands of people displaced in Selangor or alone. And if you look at rural areas, there's even more. And so there's sort of two things that kind of make this worse for lower income people. The first is that when bad things happen, you typically rely on savings or supports of social networks. And if you're poor, you know, it's sort of been shown and proven that you don't have very much of savings or social support to rely on. So sort of the buffer between you and, say, falling into poverty or being destitute is very little, right? There's not much of a cushion, so to say. And additionally, if you live in a rural area, you risk being cut off completely from resources like food, like electricity, like clean water. So that sort of, you know, makes things worse as well. And the second thing I wanted to bring up, which is not really talked about very much, is sort of the risk of living in areas that are more prone to climate disasters. What we're seeing now is that this risk is not actually being priced into the price of the homes. So what I mean is that, you know, houses that are maybe in areas that are more prone to flooding are actually cheaper in price than what they should be had you take into account the fact that, you know, it's just riskier to live there. You're more prone to flooding, you have a higher risk of damage to your house, etc. And so because these houses are not, you know, properties are not sort of priced appropriately, the groups who end up buying these houses typically are going to be poorer people because they're cheaper, and therefore they're going to then suffer as a consequence. So the risk of living in such sort of climate fragile homes or in climate fragile areas should be taken into account in the pricing of the property, which we really aren't seeing that much now. And so this is another thing that I think exacerbates issues for poor people.
So what economic measures have been implemented by other countries to manage and mitigate climate disasters, and what could we potentially do?
So there's, of course, a lot of, you know, like structural planning stuff. So I don't do city planning or architecture very much, but I know a lot of countries have, you know, sort of done a little bit more about that. But we do know, and something that a lot of countries have been guiding, you know, sort of working towards, is thinking a little bit about how it will affect how the economy changes. So we do know that, you know, from economic models from Asian Development Bank and World Bank, I was reading a study that said that, you know, droughts and floods will probably, you know, have the effect of reducing rice yields by 60%. And we know that Droughts or really high temperature, no rain, may impact the cultivation of rubber, of palm oil, of cocoa. And so we know this is really bad news for Malaysia because we eat a lot of rice in our diet. And so, you know, there's sort of a food security issue to be concerned about as well. Now, other countries, I think, have, you know, thought about how to grow more food, how to sort of decrease maybe dependence on global supply chain. So as we've seen during COVID, you know, countries that rely on heavily on sort of trade kind of suffered a little bit because, you know, if they're not exporting, if the ports are closing because of COVID, then that's bad for you, right? And so that's also bad for us because we're not able to grow everything that we need to feed everybody who lives here. So thinking about, you know, how do we protect ourselves against food security issues? And the other thing to note is that, like I mentioned, with climate change impacting, you know, commodities, right? So our economy is very heavily dependent on commodities like palm oil. And so how can we sort of diversify? How can we strengthen our ability to, you know, still sort of, you know, operate an economy and keep it going, despite the fact that, you know, climate changes will have big effects on what we can produce, what we can sell, and sort of how we make income as a country.
So moving on then to our next topic, which we highlighted earlier, recruitment of foreign workers in the country. It was announced yesterday that a select committee has been set up to expedite the approval process. What did you make of this?
So I think, I mean, everybody probably realizes at this point that in certain sectors, there has been a lot of disruption, meaning there haven't been enough people to work the jobs. And so the committee was basically set up, I think, by the Ministry of Human Resources. So I think way back in December, there was an agreement by the cabinet that they would sort of, I think, limit or look, take a closer look at recruitment of foreign workers in certain sectors. But I think in February 15th, they started allowing employers to hire foreign workers in all employment sectors, but you had to go through an application. And so the announcement that was made yesterday is sort of surrounding creating a committee in order to help process these applications quicker in order to resolve a lot of the labor shortages in the country.
So aside from the pandemic and border restrictions, one of the major factors contributing to the shortage of foreign workers is the issue of low wages and mistreatment. Could you expand on this and why it's important that we push to combat this?
So, I mean, this is a great question, and I think one that is very dear to my heart. So I think in general, we should think about two things, right? So how our position in the region is changing, and it is. And the second thing is, you know, how we've seen a lot of cracks in the, you know, treatment of migrant workers and, you know, of sort of migrant labor in general, and sort of how can we learn and do better from that, especially given all the COVID outbreaks that we've seen. So for a long time, we sort of as a country, I think, have been able to get away with paying low wages, providing migrant workers with very subpar work amenities. We've also seen how this has caused issues on a variety of fronts. So we have, you know, trade restrictions with the U.S. on certain sectors, Malaysian business sectors because of, you know, human rights or labor rights violations. We've had COVID-19 outbreaks that have disrupted supply chains, caused factories to have to close down, et cetera. Our neighbors are getting richer. That's another thing. So I think Indonesia recently announced that they're going to try and phase out, you know, sending sort of, you know, low-skilled labor to us. And so, you know, coming to sort of work in Malaysia may no longer be lucrative, right? And so who's going to work these jobs, I guess? And so one thing that people have argued is that increasing wages should help, and, you know, making sure people get paid well, making sure there's support for them, insurance, you know, life insurance support as well, that could help. But I think less attention is paid to the conditions, the working conditions, and making sure, you know, people are able to report if employers are violating labor laws and if they're being mistreated and there's sort of legal recourse to all of this. So we should think about providing good jobs, right? And the hope is that if we provide good jobs and be humane to everybody, that this will, you know, if we do this for the migrant population, then this will be something that can positively affect everybody in the country, regardless of citizenship status.
So then what kind of policy change do we need to ensure that our foreign workers are treated better?
So I think the joke that people like to say in like the policy circles is that I think we're very good at making policies, but we're not very good at enforcement. And so we really need like better enforcement. We need employers to be held and to be held very strictly to internationally reputable standards. And, you know, this is something that I think individuals can't do, but I strongly believe that, you know, the government, if they want, if we want to appear as sort of a destination, you know, for good work, for meaningful work for people. And, you know, in a situation where we can all develop the country together, I think this is something that is sorely needed.
There's also been a push for the MEF to allow refugees, undocumented migrants and prisoners, prisoners on minor crimes to work in industries that are facing labor shortages. Do you support this call?
Yes, absolutely. So I've done quite a lot of work on refugee work rights, and I sort of truly believe that this is a great step. I welcome this wholeheartedly. I think something that we sort of need to remember, so, you know, we are beholden to a variety of international law documents, right? And so one of the big ones is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right? So an international document adopted by the UN General Assembly. And in that document, the right to work is considered a human right. And so I think what it says is like, oh, everybody has a right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. So work is a huge part of, you know, human lives and something that we should strive to protect. So just because somebody's legal status of being a refugee, which is actually a status protected again by international law, or if you're somebody who's committed minor crimes, or if you're undocumented, you know, you do still have a right to work. And this doesn't mean that just because of your legal status, you should be barred from being able to make a livelihood for yourself. And so there are generally two arguments to supporting this. The first is sort of humanitarian, meaning, you know, we should allow people to work. We should allow them to do this because they're people and we should care about people. And, you know, in fact, we are already doing this in the country. People are already sort of working informally. But the second argument is practical, that, you know, we've just been discussing many sectors facing shortages, and many of these individuals can actually fill the labor gap. So for both reasons, I think this would be a great solution for the country to allow this. And people often think about sort of sectors that employ, you know, foreign workers and refugees and stuff as being like unskilled, but this is not true. So, you know, I've studied the construction industry very extensively, and the work in this sector is actually highly skilled. So it's apprenticeship based. It can take years in order to be able to, you know, like put bricks together, do wiring. So in many ways, you know, this type of work is very similar to like getting a degree in a technical field, like law, programming. And so with these jobs that already employ, you know, a significant amount of undocumented people and migrants and refugees, and they're already skilled, I think we should make it so that their work and labor is legal, we can protect them more, and we can sort of ensure that the workplace that they're at is a dignified place that, you know, they can be safe and be dignified and be happy about, and we can as well as a country.
Dr. Melathi, thanks for speaking with us. That was Dr. Melathi Nungsari, Assistant Professor of Economics at the Asia School of Business and Research Affiliate at MIT in Boston. You've been listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.